all the performance characteristics of the new airplane. Could you fire air-to-ground missiles from that airplane while going at Mach 3 speed? The general asked Kelly. Kelly replied affirmatively. We've done the theoretics on this, General, and we feel confident that we could do this successfully. Could you guide a missile to within 200 feet of a target? LeMay asked. Kelly again said yes, theoretically, and added that if the missiles were nuclear, pinpoint accuracy was unnecessary. Used as a deep-penetration tactical bomber, the Russians couldn't stop us. Used as an interceptor, we were also unstoppable. Using look-down, shoot-down, air-to-air missiles, our high-flying interceptor could defend all of North America against any long-range bomber force that would be expected to fly low to the deck to avoid radar detection. With our speed, Kelly insisted, fewer interceptors would be needed to cover the entire North American continent. We'd look down at the Soviet bomber fleet and pick them off like fish in a barrel. Kelly declared, General, the fellow who gains the high ground takes the battle. Our speed gives us our height. We're king of the mountain. LeMay suddenly raised his hand as a signal for Kelly to stop talking. Then he stood up, grabbed Kelly by the arm, and led him to the far corner of Kelly's huge office for a private, whispered conference that lasted nearly 10 minutes, while the rest of us sat transfixed, watching these two titans of military aviation cooking up some sort of scheme or scenario. Kelly told us later that LeMay was enthusiastic about using the Blackbird as an interceptor, but resisted the idea of using it as a bomber. The B-70 was still very much on his mind. Johnson, I want a promise out of you that you won't lobby any more against the B-70. Kelly agreed, a promise he would deeply regret in the years ahead. We'll buy your interceptors. I don't have a number yet, but I'll get back to you soon. Kelly asked, What about the reconnaissance aircraft we built for the agency? Can't the Air Force use any? LeMay looked dismayed. You mean we haven't ordered any? He wrote a note to himself and promised Kelly he would forward an Air Force contract for the two-seater version of the spy plane within a few weeks. The very next day, Kelly was tipped off by a colonel on LeMay's staff that on the trip back to Washington aboard his jet, LeMay revised his thinking rather sharply and ordered his staff to develop a proposal for building 10 Blackbird interceptors and 10 tactical bombers a month. For once, Kelly was speechless. If this really comes to pass, he told me, our whole concept of operation will have to change. This would be such a staggering operation when you consider it means building one airplane every other working day that I doubt we could do it successfully using our Lockheed facilities here in Southern California. I could be wrong, but let's do a study and see precisely what it would take. The size of LeMay's shopping list reinforced our feeling that the administration was quietly and quickly gearing up for a major military showdown with the Russians. That conviction grew a few weeks later, when Secretary McNamara himself arrived at our doorstep under a tight lid of secrecy to be briefed by Kelly, review our management methods on the project, and see the Blackbird for himself. He brought with him all his top people, Secretary of the Air Force Joseph Cherek, Assistant Defense Secretary Roswell Gilpatrick, and the Air Force's future Secretary Harold Brown. Kelly briefed, while McNamara took copious notes, and asked several questions about the airplane's unique navigational system. It was the first astro-navigational system that actually used a small, computer-driven telescope to find approximately 60 stars in its database. The telescope looked through a small window toward the rear of the airplane and was extremely accurate and reliable locking onto stars. It was so sensitive that it once locked onto a rivet hole in the hangar roof, when the system was accidentally turned on during airplane servicing. McNamara wanted to know all about it. This is the most accurate navigational system we can devise, Kelly said. Remember, we are traveling at twice the speed of a 16-inch shell, and we don't turn on a dime. A tight turn takes between 60 and 100 nautical miles, and if a pilot gets a little sloppy, he could start a turn over Atlanta and end up over Chattanooga. Several of us escorted the official party during the inspection tour of the Blackbird inside the giant assembly building. One of the generals on the secretary's staff took me aside. "Mr. Rich," he said, "I don't understand why you're building those large spikes to block air coming into the inlet. What is the principle here? It seems to me you'd want the air unimpeded." I couldn't believe that an Air Force general would ask such a naive question. I said, "General, the object is to build up pressure at high altitudes. Did you ever try to squirt water from a hose by placing your thumb over the opening?" His nod showed a glimmer of understanding. By the time McNamara and his party boarded their jet for a red-eye flight back to Washington, Kelly was practically dancing a polka. The briefing could not have gone better. We expected purchase orders to follow, and we weren't disappointed. As an immediate follow-up, Lou Meyer, the Air Force Assistant Secretary for Finance, flew out the following week and informed us that we would probably get orders for 10 Blackbird reconnaissance aircraft for the Air Force, in addition to the 10 we were building for the CIA. They wanted a larger two-seater version, with a pilot up front and a navigator electronics specialist, called a reconnaissance systems officer, in a separate rear cockpit, working the routing as well as operating all the special avionics for capturing enemy radar frequencies and electronic intercepts. We would also be receiving a contract for 10 fighter interceptor versions of the Blackbird and 25 tactical bombers. These orders would be worth hundreds of millions of dollars and seem to defy the longtime Pentagon quasi-socialistic policy of never putting all their purchases in one manufacturer's shopping cart. Spreading the profits among the key manufacturers was the usual military-industrial game, but it really seemed that the era of the Blackbird was at hand. Blackbird spy planes, Blackbird interceptors, and Blackbird bombers. The Blackbird so outmatched any other airplane in the world with its speed and altitude, it would dominate air warfare for at least a decade or more. Before 1962 ended, Kelly had obtained approval from Lockheed Management to construct a million-dollar engineering building on the strength of the proposed expansion of the Blackbird programs. Our in-house study, meanwhile, indicated we would need $22 million in additional funds to increase production facilities to meet the large production quotas of Mach 3 Blackbird fighters and bombers the Air Force expected to order. All of us began counting our big bonuses long before the check was in the mail, and all of us were in for one big letdown. I remember my producer brother telling me once about a young filmmaker who had been courted by a big studio, actually being kissed on both cheeks by the reigning mogul and declared a genius, and his script given the top priority for quick production. But a month later, that same young genius could not even get his calls returned. He had gone from hot to cold with no apparent explanation. That typical Hollywood story became the metaphor for the Blackbird scenario, as played out by the Kennedy administration. Suddenly, Kelly could not get calls returned from key administration players, making decisions about Blackbird bombers and interceptors. A few top generals began ducking him, too. And the word drifting back to us from the Pentagon was that McNamara's young Turks, advising him on cost-effectiveness, refused to believe that the Russians were actually developing a supersonic backfire bomber. Without that threat, the Blackbird was not a necessary deterrent. McNamara's Turks insisted we could get by using the old standby fighter, the Convair F-106. This was the updated version of the F-102 Delta Wing fighter that was the backbone of the Air Defense Command. Both of these airplanes had only supersonic dash, Mach 1.8 capability, their fuel capacity limited to a scant 5 minutes of supersonic flight. Kelly thought Mac the Knife had taken leave of his senses, but he was not in the loop about planning for possible U.S. military intervention in Vietnam and the secret preparations for air and ground action by our forces. As a first step, McNamara approved a new classified prototype for the first swing-wing tactical fighter called the TFX, Tactical Fighter Experimental, that would specialize in ground attack. Built by General Dynamics, it was destined to be one of the most controversial airplanes of the era, involving tens of millions in cost overruns, as its designers struggled to solve the horrendous problems of a movable wing, parallel on takeoff and becoming swept back as the airplane gained Mach 2 speed. The Air Force wanted the F-111 as it was officially designated, to come in on the deck, evading radar by hiding in the ground clutter, to support local troop action in hostile ground action. But the first F-111s used in Vietnam took tremendous losses because their terrain-following radar, which allowed them to skim over treetops in the dead of night, acted like a powerful beacon for enemy radar to home in on. Even worse, most of us in the Skunk Works thought that the minute look-down, shoot-down radar fire control systems were perfected, airplanes like the F-111 would become obsolete. A higher-flying MiG pilot looking down on a squadron of F-111s could become a combat ace in seconds. To prove the Blackbird's tremendous performance capabilities to McNamara, we launched a flight in May 1962 from Edwards Air Force Base outside Los Angeles to Orlando, Florida, that blazed across the country in 1 hour and 28 minutes. And if he wasn't paying attention, we sent another Blackbird winging east from San Diego, which arrived over Savannah Beach, Georgia, only 59 minutes later. We also started development of a weapons system for the Blackbird that would demonstrate how easily an airplane like the F-111 could be shot down while flying at the treetops. This weapon was look-down, shoot-down radar and air-to-air missiles. Developing it, we were 25 years ahead of anyone else. We took an existing $80 million air-to-air missile developed by Hughes, called the GAR-9, and a Westinghouse ASG-18 radar system, both created for the Navy, and augmented them with our own special fire control system. The results stunned the Blue Suiters, who thought it was impossible to successfully fire a missile from an airplane speeding at 3 times the speed of sound. Most air-to-air missiles traveled 5, 10, 15 miles to targets locked on at the same altitude or slightly below or above. We locked onto targets more than 100 miles away and tens of thousands of feet below. From 80,000 feet, we knocked out drones flying on the deck at 1,500 feet. From 87,000 feet, we hit a drone flying at 40,000 feet. To keep the missile from hitting our own airplane, we added a trapeze device to the missile launch system and used ejection cartridges to drop the missile nose down before it fired and sped off to the target at Mach 6. Our first test of the new system occurred in March 1965. We hit a drone from 36 miles away at a closing rate of 2,000 miles per hour. A few weeks later, we fired the missile from 75,000 feet while traveling at Mach 3.2 and hit a drone flying at 40,000 feet, 38 miles away. But a few months later, we really rocked the Air Force. From 75,000 feet, we hit a low-altitude remote-controlled B-47 flying over the Gulf of Mexico at 1,200 feet from 80 miles off. Kelly was overjoyed. Our testing was a superlative 12 hits out of 13 attempts, firing from all heights and ranges. It was the most successful new weapons test in history. Our missile should have blasted a big hole in the administration's backing of the F-111, which now was proven by our tests to be obsolete before it even flew. We knew the Russians were crashing a program to develop this kind of look-down, shoot-down system. Once it was in place aboard their newest MiG interceptors, life would be hell for any pilot in a low-flying aircraft like the F-111. Our message to the Blue Suiters? Tell McNamara he's backing the wrong bomber. Their message back? Tell him yourself. He won't listen to us. Kelly flew to Washington in the winter of 1966 and stormed in on Air Force Secretary Harold Brown, who was also rather blunt, and the two went head-to-head. Kelly called the F-111 a national scandal if the administration forced it on the Air Force, in spite of the evidence of its vulnerability to our missile system. There was no justification for building this dog, except maybe because it was being built in LBJ's backyard, Fort Worth, Texas. In fairness to McNamara, the Air Force was pushing for the TFX. They wanted a tactical fighter-bomber that could be used in big numbers in a ground war like Vietnam. The Blackbird was too revolutionary and too costly to fly regularly in harm's way. The Air Force High Command worried that it would be shot down, and its technological secrets fall into enemy hands. But General LeMay won a partial concession from McNamara, and we received a contract for 6 2-man reconnaissance versions of the Blackbird to to be built exclusively for the Air Force. The plane would be ultimately designated as the SR-71. It was larger and heavier than the CIA one-pilot model that carried only cameras. The Air Force model would be packed with both cameras and super-sophisticated electronic eavesdropping equipment. The Skunk Works eventually would build 31 of them, before this amazing airplane was finally, and some would say prematurely, retired in the winter of 1990. By then, the Blackbird had become a legend as an incredibly effective operational surveillance aircraft that could safely overfly the most hostile and dangerous territory at will. But the airplane and its operations were kept so secret that few, inside or outside our government, knew it was flying. But the Russians knew. So did the North Koreans, North Vietnamese, and Chinese. And there was nothing they could do to stop it. 11. Remembering Habu. More than 30 years after its first flight, the Blackbird's records will not soon be surpassed. New York to London in 1 hour and 55 minutes. London to L.A. in 3 hours and 47 minutes. L.A. to Washington in 64 minutes. The Blackbird was 40% faster than the Concorde, which first flew 7 years later. And in 1964, its creation won Kelly Johnson his second Collier Trophy, aviation's most prestigious award. He had won his first Collier 5 years earlier for building the world's first supersonic fighter, the F-104. No one else in the industry had ever won two Collier trophies, and that record will probably endure too. President Johnson awarded Kelly the Medal of Freedom, our nation's highest civilian award, in 1967, not long after authorizing the first Blackbird overflights of North Vietnam in May of that year. The president wanted hard evidence to back up rumors that the North was receiving surface-to-surface long-range ballistic missiles from the Russians that could reach Saigon. Two CIA-piloted Blackbirds flown by the agency out of Kadena Air Base in Okinawa that summer were dispatched by presidential command to find out what was really happening. They covered the whole of North Vietnam photographically and found no evidence whatever of the presence of ground-to-ground missiles. Kelly joked that LBJ bestowed the Medal of Freedom on him more in expression of his relief than in gratitude. For budgetary purposes, LBJ ordered the CIA out of the spy plane business in May 1968, and from then on, all the missions involving Blackbirds were conducted entirely by the Air Force in its two-seater Blackbird, the SR-71. The second man, assisting the pilot in the first cockpit, was the reconnaissance systems officer, seated in the separate rear cockpit, who operated all the avionics as well as the non-automatic cameras and radar frequency recording systems. I won the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics Award in 1972 for designing the Blackbird's propulsion system. But because the airplane operated in such secrecy for the Air Force, and its training flights were conducted over least populated areas at tremendously high altitudes, few Americans ever saw it fly, and the public was only vaguely aware of its existence. After LBJ officially announced the Blackbird's creation in 1964, the Air Force was allowed to fly the airplane for official speed and altitude records over closed courses in 1965. The Blackbird established a new speed record of 2,070 miles per hour and an altitude record of 80,257 feet, even though over the 25 years it was operational, it routinely broke these records many times over while outclimbing and outspeeding missile attacks. On one operational flight in 1976, a Blackbird actually reached 85,068 feet while flying at 2,092 miles per hour. Even now, many years after the fact, the public remains oblivious to the harrowing and dangerous missions the airplane flew on an almost daily basis for more than a quarter century. Many rumors still surround the routine penetration overflights by the Blackbirds over such heavily defended denied territories as North Korea, North Vietnam, Cuba, Libya, and the whole of the Soviet and Eastern Bloc border, including intensive surveillance of the Russian nuclear submarine pens in the far-frozen north. The Blackbird also performed a daily surveillance flight across the length of the demilitarized zone in Korea. General Larry Welch, as the Blue Suitor's chief of staff, recalled having lunch with his South Korean counterpart near the DMZ, when suddenly all the dishes rattled and the room rocked with a loud kaboom from the Blackbird's sonic boom. The Korean general smiled at Welch and sighed with satisfaction. Ah, so. We in the Skunk Works believed that the airplane's height and speed, as well as its pioneering stealthy composite materials applied to key areas of its wings and tail, would keep it and its crew safe. But we fortified that belief by adding a special fuel additive which we nicknamed Panther Piss that ionized the furnace-like gas plumes streaming from the engine exhausts. The additive caused enemy infrared detectors to break up incoherently. We also implanted a black box electronic countermeasure in the airplane's tail called Oscar Sierra. The pilots called it "Oh shit," which is what most of them exclaimed when an ECM system activated at the start of an enemy missile attack. This ECM confused and distracted missile radar and kept it from locking on. Time and again, the airplane and its countermeasure equipment proved their worth over North Vietnam, Cuba, and Northern Russia. But mostly we could just outspeed any homing missile that would have to be led at least 30 miles ahead of its target to reach the Blackbird's altitude of 16 miles high and at 2,000 miles per hour plus speeds. Most missiles exploded harmlessly 2 to 5 miles behind the streaking SR-71. Often, the crew was not even aware they had been fired upon. The Blackbirds flew 3,500 operational sorties over Vietnam and other hostile countries, had more than 100 SAM SA-2 missiles fired at them over the years, and retired gracefully in 1990 after 24 years of service as the only military airplane never to be shot down or lose a single crewman to enemy fire, which was truly amazing, because the Blackbird and its crews continuously drew the most dangerous missions. At such tremendous flying speeds, the margin for judgmental or mechanical error was zero, and at times, crews flew 14-hour round-trip flights more than halfway around the world from their base in Okinawa, for example, to the Persian Gulf, providing fast, urgently needed intelligence estimates on missile emplacements along the Iranian coast. The complexity and duration of some of these missions defied belief, with 10 or more air refuel rendezvous strung out along tens of thousands of miles of the typical long-range Blackbird route. One screw-up could result in tanks going dry, a crashed airplane, and a lost crew. But it never happened, not once, during a total of 65 million miles of flying, mostly at 3 times the speed of sound. Like the U-2, the Blackbird was not an easy airplane to fly. It demanded a pilot's total concentration and was unforgiving of even smallish mistakes. The recollections of pilots and crews attest to the awe and challenge of flying at speeds almost beyond human comprehension. Personnel were assigned to the 9th Strategic Reconnaissance Wing out of Beale Air Force Base near Sacramento, California, composed of 13 two-man crews flying 9 active Blackbirds and supported closely by a fleet of 25 KC-135s, the huge fuel tankers that fanned out across the world to rendezvous with thirsty Blackbirds for air-to-air refueling. The crews who flew these missions were selected by SAC from the top of their list. Of the first 10 pilots chosen, 9 ultimately became generals. To a man, all the pilots and their reconnaissance systems officers, RSOs, in the second cockpit regarded their tours as members of the elite Blackbird unit as the highlight of their Air Force careers. Other voices. Colonel Jim Watkins, pilot. I had 600 hours piloting Blackbird, and my last flight was just as big a thrill as my first. At 85,000 feet in Mach 3, it was almost a religious experience. My first flight out of Beale in 67, I took off late on a winter afternoon, heading east where it was already dark, and it was one of the most amazing and frightening moments, going from daylight into a dark curtain of night that seemed to be hung across half of the continent. There was nothing in between. You streaked from bright day and flew into utter black, like being swallowed up into an abyss. My God, even now I get goosebumps remembering. We flew to the East Coast, then turned around and headed back to California, and saw the sun rising in the west as we re-entered daylight. We were actually outspeeding the Earth's rotation. Nothing had prepared me to fly that fast. A typical training flight, we'd take off from Beale, then head east. I'd look out and see the Great Salt Lake. Hell of a landmark. Then look back in the cockpit to be sure everything was okay. Then look out again, and the Great Salt Lake had vanished. In its place, the Rockies. Then you scribbled on your flight plan and looked out again, this time at the Mississippi River. You were gobbling up huge hunks of geography by the minute. Hell, you're flying 3,000 feet a second. We flew coast to coast and border to border in 3 hours, 59 minutes with 2 air-to-air refuelings. One day I heard another SR-71 pilot calling Albuquerque Center. I recognized his voice and knew he was flying lower than me, but in the vicinity. So I called and said, "Tony, dump some fuel so I can see you." In only a couple of blinks of an eye, fuel streaked by underneath my airplane. He was like 150 miles ahead of me. One day our automatic navigation system failed. Ordinarily, that's an automatic abort situation, but I decided to try to fly without the automatic navigation. I advised the FAA I was going to try this and to monitor us and let us know where we were if we got lost. I quickly learned that if we started a turn 1 second late, we were already off course. And if my bank angle wasn't exact, I was off by a long shot. I started a turn just below L.A. and wound up over Mexico. I realized right then that we couldn't navigate by the seat of our pants, not at those incredible speeds. I remember when a new pilot flying the SR-71 for the first time out of Beale began shouting, "Mayday, mayday," over Salt Lake City. "My nose is coming off!" My God, we all panicked and cranked out all the emergency vehicles. The guy aborted, staggered back to Beale. All that really happened was that the airplane's nose wrinkled from the heat. The skin always did that. The crew smoothed it out using a blowtorch. It was just like ironing a shirt. My favorite route was to refuel over the Pacific right after takeoff, then come in over Northern California going supersonic, flying just north of Grand Forks, North Dakota, then turn to avoid Chicago, swing over Georgia, then coast out over the Atlantic, then refuel over Florida, west of Miami, then head straight back to Beale. Total elapsed time, 3 hours, 22 minutes. Take off at 9 or 10 in the morning and land before 2 in the afternoon, in time to play tennis before cocktail hour. As time went on, we were being routed over least populated areas because of growing complaints about sonic booms. One of them came straight from Nixon. One of our airplanes boomed him while he was reading on the patio of his estate at San Clemente. He got on the horn to the chief of staff and said, "God damn it, you're disturbing people." One little community named Susanville in California sat right in a valley and was in the path of our return route to Beale. The sonic boom would echo off the hills and crack windows and plaster. We had the townspeople in, showed them the airplane, appealed to their patriotism, and told them the boom was the sound of freedom. They lapped it up. Walt W. Rostow, President Johnson's National Security Advisor from 1966 to 1968. The Blackbird reconnaissance missions over North Vietnam, which began in late 1966, were invaluable to the president. We learned precisely the locations of missile and anti-aircraft batteries, what ships were in the harbor unloading, and obtained up-to-date targeting intelligence for our bombing missions. Without these Blackbird overflights of Haiphong and Hanoi, President Johnson would never have allowed any tactical air operations in the north because he was extremely sensitive, I think in some ways overly sensitive, to the possibilities of a bomb accidentally hitting a Chinese or Russian ship while it was unloading in the harbor, and he also was determined to keep civilian damage and casualties to a minimum. So he demanded frequent Blackbird missions, 2 or 3 every week to supply him with the latest intelligence, since he usually chose the targets personally and insisted on approving each and every raid in the north. The military offered their priorities for targets, and the questions he raised about proposed targets were always the same. What were the military consequences of taking out that particular target? What were the expected losses in men and airplanes on this particular raid? And how much secondary civilian damage was anticipated? Before signing off on a mission, he calculated in his own mind whether the anticipated losses were worth the anticipated gains, and the Blackbird photos were the decisive factors in helping him to make up his mind. On January 23, 1968, the North Koreans caught us by surprise by boarding a naval surveillance ship called the Pueblo while it was in international waters. We were really caught short, not knowing the fate of the crew or the ship. We figured they planned that incident to divert us at the time of the Tet Offensive in South Vietnam, but we would be damned if we'd let them get away with it. The whole country was up in arms over this incident. The president was considering using air power to hit them hard and try to shake our crewmen loose. But when we cooled down, we had to suck in our gut and hold back until we were certain about the situation. Dick Helms, the director of the CIA, urged the president to authorize Blackbird flights to try to locate the missing ship. LBJ was reluctant to overfly North Korea and offer the tempting target of the Blackbird, possibly provoking an even greater international incident. But he was assured that Blackbird could photograph the whole of North Korea from the DMZ to the Yalu River in less than 10 minutes, and probably do so unobserved by air defense radar. Which is precisely what happened. The Blackbird quickly located the captured Pueblo at anchor in Wonsan Harbor, only 24 hours after it was boarded by the North Koreans. So we had to abandon any plans to hit them with air power. All that would accomplish would be to kill a lot of people, including our own. But the Blackbird's photo take provided proof that our ship and our men were being held. The Koreans couldn't lie about that, and we immediately began negotiations to get them back. Captain Norbert Budzinski, Air Force RSO. We trained a year, acquired 100 hours of flying time before we flew out to Giant Kadena Air Base at Okinawa in early 1968. The trip took about 6 hours by SR-71, 14 hours if you flew over in a tanker. This was for real. The slower and lower U-2s couldn't make it flying over North Vietnam with all those SAM sites. That mission became ours. We flew 5 times a week on average. Also, missions over North Korea and to Soviet naval facilities north of Japan. We operated 3 airplanes and lived isolated from the main base population in a remote corner of Kadena that had been set up for the original CIA pilots and crew. But very quickly the islanders learned we were there and would go up on the hill overlooking the base to catch a glimpse of our bird, which shook the whole island taking off. The islanders nicknamed our airplane Habu, after a black, extremely deadly pit viper. Habu, like the Blackbird, was indigenous to Okinawa, and the name stuck. We carried that name on our shoulder patches. To this day, that hill is still called Habu Hill by the islanders. The minute we showed up at Kadena, so did 2 Soviet trawlers, which fed our takeoff times and position to their friends in North Vietnam and put them on the alert. But we were cocky. We timed our flights not for surprise, but to achieve the most favorable sun angle for our pictures, usually taking off between 10 in the morning and noon. We made a big turn and banked to head for Hanoi, exposing ourselves on the side to those giant Tall King long-range radars that the Chinese installed on Hainan Island. They knew we had 2 primary targets, Haiphong and Hanoi, so it was just a matter of timing us and waiting for us to fly over their missile sites. We collected so much photo and electronic intelligence data from each mission that our intelligence people were swamped by it and simply couldn't keep up. We photographed 100,000 square miles of terrain per hour, from which selected target images could be blown up more than 20 times. Some of the cameras were operated by me as the RSO in the back seat, and others were automatic. The cameras were very fast and pre-programmed. We could provide both horizon-to-horizon coverage and close-up telescopic work that would let you see down a flea's throat. Okinawa is one hell of a long way from Vietnam. Our missions averaged more than 6,000 miles and took more than 4 hours. The logistics involved were staggering because we had refueling tankers strung out from Kadena to Thailand. So we usually flew 2 airplanes, using one as a spare in case the mission plane had to crap out. Having all those tankers in the sky was expensive. Typically, we'd hit a tanker 15 minutes after takeoff, head on down between Taiwan and the Philippines to Cam Ranh Bay, then turn north over North Vietnam. We'd overfly the north in 8 to 12 minutes, take in both Haiphong and Hanoi, staying out of range of the SA-2 missile batteries down below. Then we'd do a double looper, going over the north again before refueling over Thailand. We overflew both north and south in Vietnam, did Laos and Cambodia, flew over both north and south in Korea. Sometimes after a mission, I'd get a look at our photo take to see how well we did. It was unbelievable. You could actually see down the open hatches of a freighter unloading in Haiphong's harbor. In fact, the photo interpreters claimed that they could tell what was down in those hatches. It was that sharp and clear from 85,000 feet. They blow up our photos to the size of a table. Frankly, I had the feeling that there were things the hostiles made no effort to hide. For example, North Korea. Took us about 10 minutes to overfly, then hit a tanker and do it again at a different latitude. These missions had to be cleared at the highest level. We concentrated on missile sites, port facilities, and the unusual movement. Those folks never moved their missile sites. They wanted us to see them, record them, not cause tensions or apprehensions by hiding them or moving them around. Same with the Chinese. We overflew them 2 or 3 years, but only with direct orders from the commander-in-chief. Those guys wanted us to know they had the bomb. That was clear. We knew we'd probably get shot at, but it wasn't a big worry because at our height an SA-2 missile simply didn't have the aerodynamic capability to maneuver once we started twisting and turning to get away from it. Still, when a little warning light came on in my cockpit to report that the boys downstairs had launched one up at me, I tightened up for sure. I personally never saw a missile coming up, but others did. One of our pilots, Bill Campbell, saw 3 missiles explode at his altitude, but a couple of miles behind. He actually watched them being launched and caught it on film. He said those damn missiles looked as big as telephone poles as they lifted off. Later on, in the late 1970s, when the Russians developed their powerful SA-5 ground-to-air missile that could have knocked us down, they never tried to use it against the Blackbird. That missile was so enormous it looked like a medium-range intercontinental ballistic missile sitting on its pad. Made me queasy just looking down at it through my telescopic sight. But my theory was that the hostiles realized that reconnaissance flights were actually stabilizing. We knew what they were looking at, and they knew what we were looking at. If they denied us, we'd deny them, and then everyone would get the jitters. In this game, you didn't deny access unless you were ready to get serious about preventing it. Lieutenant Colonel Buzz Carpenter, Air Force pilot. We were flying over North Vietnam at 82,000 feet when suddenly I had to do a quick maneuver to keep us from colliding with a weather balloon that whisked past us just off my wingtip. At that very moment, we experienced an unstart in the left engine, which knocked me and my RSO all over our respective cockpits. My RSO looks out and sees the left engine trailing fuel, and he thinks we've been hit by a SAM. "Buzz, we've been hit," he shouts into his open mic. I always suspected that we were more closely monitored on these flights than we probably realized by special RC-135 Snooper airplanes packed with powerful electronics. And now I'm certain, because by the time we made our second pass over the north, the White House Situation Room had already been wrongly notified that my SR-71 had been hit over Hanoi. Major Butch Sheffield, Air Force RSO. Just before I deployed to Kadena in the fall of 69, we were tasked to fly up to the Arctic Circle and check on some suspicious activity on a tiny Russian island. I was then stationed at Beale, living at home with my wife. We took off after breakfast, refueled over Alaska, headed north for 1,500 miles. It was scary being over the most forbidding area of the world. If you had to eject, you were finished. Anyway, we reached this island, turned on the recorders and the cameras, then turned around, hit another tanker, and flew back into Beale. I was home in time for dinner, and my wife never knew where I'd been that day. She assumed it was just another day at the office. At dinner, I almost burst out laughing, thinking of her reaction if she had known I'd spent the day flying up and back to the Arctic Circle. I had another very odd mission, like that one in the early 1970s while stationed at Kadena. We were tasked to fly against the very formidable and new Soviet SA-5 missile site that had been constructed at Vladivostok, their big naval base in the Sea of Japan, at a time when the Russians were conducting a huge naval exercise right off the coast. We were to fly to this dangerous site late Sunday night, hoping that we would find their most junior officers on duty, who would snap at the bait and turn on their radar and we could measure the frequency, the pulse repetition intervals, and a lot of other vital technical details that could be used to develop counter-electronics against this monster. A more experienced officer might figure out what we were really up to and stay dark. The National Security Agency put aboard a special recording package for this particular mission, and we flew right down the throat of that site, so that it seemed certain that we were going to overfly Soviet territory. As we came in, radars from dozens of Soviet naval ships on that training exercise switched on, and at the last second we pulled a sharp turn and avoided any overflight of Soviet airspace. But the take was awesome. In all, we got nearly 300 different radar transmissions recorded, including the first SA-5 signals obtained by our side. Meanwhile, I had plenty of problems to cope with before we landed safely. After turning, we headed toward Japan. During that big turn, the oil pressure on the left engine began falling and rapidly dropped to zero. We stayed on a southern heading but shut down that engine and flew on one engine against awful headwinds at 15,000 feet as we approached the North Korean coastline. We were just struggling to maintain altitude and didn't realize it until later that the North Koreans had scrambled fighters against us and that the South Koreans had scrambled their fighters to get between us and the North Koreans and defend us. We had no choice but to put into a South Korean airbase at Taegu. I called the field, but they refused permission to land. "Field closed," they said. I said, "I've got to land. Turn on your lights." We came in and just sat there, surrounded by dozens of people in black pajamas with machine guns. My pilot said to me, "Butch, you sure we landed in South Korea?" On November 22, 1969, I flew my first North Korea mission. I was uptight because North Korea was very heavily defended, and on this particular mission, we went to every known SAM site in North Korea, all 21 of them, and we crisscrossed them, made a big 180-degree turn that took us right across the Chinese border, then came back right down the center of North Korea, then made another 180-degree turn across the demilitarized zone. We crossed North Korea 8 to 10 times on that mission, covered the entire country. As we finished up and were turning to go home, a right generator fail light came on. I tried to reset it, but it was no go, so we ended up making an emergency landing in the south and caused a big stir and fuss. In 71, we were tasked to fly 3 Blackbirds over North Vietnam, which was highly unusual. All other missions used only one airplane at a time. We took off first, refueled over Thailand, and headed north with the other 2 planes following. The plan was for us to crisscross over Hanoi in 30-second intervals at 78, 76, and 74,000 feet, respectively. At a certain point, which we later learned was over the Hanoi Hilton, the infamous POW prison, and deliver sonic booms one after another. Later on, the vice commander of our squadron hinted that the purpose of the mission was to send a signal to the POWs, a fact I've never been able to confirm. Many years later, I talked to POWs who were in that prison at the time, and they heard the sonic booms 30 seconds apart, but insisted that they didn't know what in hell it meant. Fred Carmody. I ran the SR-71 operation for Lockheed at Mildenhall, an RAF base in Suffolk, from 1982 to 1989. We had 2 SR-71s, and when I went in with 18 Skunk Works mechanics, I replaced 80 Air Force mechanics who had suffered 8 aborted missions in a row. We took over and immediately logged 8 successful flights in a row, and had those blue suitors scratching their heads. The Mildenhall operation was revealed by the Prime Minister, Mrs. Thatcher, about 2 years after we got there. Our main deployment was to fly twice a week up to the northern extremes of the Soviet Union, to the big naval base of Murmansk on the Kola Peninsula, to keep a sharp eye on their nuclear subpens. That place was so remote it took us 3 air-to-air refuelings to get there, which is why they put their subs there to begin with. The place was very heavily defended by fighters and missiles, but only the Blackbird could fly it safely. They always detected us, but they couldn't stop us. We flew right up against them, but didn't actually penetrate Soviet airspace. That was a big no-no by presidential orders. In case of emergency, engine problems and such, we had to put into Norway. That happened 3 times. We took pictures of the subs in their pens, saw which ones were occupied, which empty. Those nuclear subs were a potential threat to our mainland because they carried Polaris-type nuclear missiles that could be fired offshore and hit Washington and New York. So we kept a close count and tracked the subs from the moment they left their pens. The pictures were so clear we could even tell the size of the sub's screws under the water, count the missile silos on the decks. We took both radar pictures and regular pictures, tested radar frequencies by penetrating their air defense systems, and then did the same thing on long flights down the Baltic coast of East Germany and Poland. The Soviets would scramble their MiG-25s against us, but they got up to only 60,000 feet, then fell off. One of them got up to Mach 3 on a zoom, then fell off. Those MiGs could reach max speeds of Mach 2.5 to 2.7, which wasn't nearly good enough to catch the SR-71. They also fired missiles at us from time to time, but we used our jammers very effectively. The purpose of the Baltic coastal flights was to gather radar and electronic intelligence, as well as obtain good photos of military facilities along the border of the Eastern Bloc. On a typical mission, we could get invaluable intelligence on as many as 50 different radar and missile tracking systems deployed against us in the Baltic and Barents Sea regions. Our guys out of England regularly overflew the Mediterranean from Greece to Tunisia. We were far superior to any damned spy satellite. You wanted a picture at 10:01 a.m. Sunday anywhere in the world? We'd go out and get it for you. We covered the world with a handful of airplanes. Lieutenant Colonel D. Kurt Osterheld, Air Force RSO. My first mission to the Soviet subpens in the Baltic was in December 1985. At 85,000 feet, the winter view of the northern Russian port areas was magnificent. The land was absolutely white in every direction, and the sea was frozen solid too, except for the dark black lines where icebreakers had been used, and I could see subs moving along the surface, heading for deeper waters. In the polar cold, we pulled engine contrails, which made us a clear target in the cloudless sky. Way down below, I could see the spiral contrails of Soviet fighters, scrambled because of us. At that time of year, the sun was very low on the horizon, even at noon. I lowered the curtain to cover the left window, so I could watch the radar and defensive systems panels in the back seat without having the sun directly in my eyes. As we approached the subpens, we received a Condition 1 alert over the high-frequency radio that got our immediate attention. An instant later, the defensive systems panel began lighting up, indicating we were being tracked and engaged by SAM missiles, and there might be a missile on the way. I advised my pilot to accelerate out to maximum Mach. I thought, if they really fired a missile, it should be here by now. At that instant, the Velcro that held the sunscreen curtain in place let go, and my cockpit was lit with brilliant light. For a split second, I thought, they got us. I let go with a shriek of terror. So much for the image of the fearless flyer, scared crapless by a blinding flash of winter sunlight. Lieutenant Colonel William Burke, Jr., Air Force pilot. In the fall of 82, I flew from Mildenhall on a mission over Lebanon in response to the Marine Barracks bombing. President Reagan ordered photo coverage of all the terrorist bases in the region. The French refused to allow us to overfly, so our mission profile was to refuel off the south coast of England, a Mach 3 cruise leg down the coast of Portugal and Spain, left turn through the Straits of Gibraltar, refuel in the western Mediterranean, pull a supersonic leg along the coast of Greece and Turkey, right turn into Lebanon and fly right down Main Street, Beirut, exit along the southern Mediterranean with another refueling over Malta, supersonic back out the straits and return to England. because Syria had a Soviet SA-5 missile system just west of Damascus that we would be penetrating, we were unsure of Syria's intentions in this conflict, we programmed to fly above 80,000 feet and at Mach 3-plus to be on the safe side, knowing that this advanced missile had the range and speed to nail us. And as we entered Lebanon's airspace, my recon systems officer in the rear cockpit informed me that our defensive systems display showed we were being tracked by that SA-5. About 15 seconds later, we got a warning of active guidance signals from the SA-5 site. We couldn't tell whether there was an actual launch or the missile was still on the rails, but they were actively tracking us. We didn't waste any time wondering, but climbed and pushed that throttle and sent a couple of Hail Kellys. We completed our pass over Beirut and turned toward Malta when I got a warning low oil pressure light on my right engine. Even though the engine was running fine, I slowed down and lowered our altitude and made a direct line for England. We decided to cross France without clearance instead of going the roundabout way. We made it almost across when I looked out the left window and saw a French Mirage 3 sitting 10 feet off my left wing. It came up on our frequency and asked for our diplomatic clearance number. I had no idea what he was talking about, so I told him to stand by. I asked my backseater, who said, "Don't worry about it, I just gave it to him." What he had given him was the bird with his middle finger. I lit the afterburners and left that Mirage standing still. 2 minutes later, we were crossing the channel. Major Randy Shellhorse, Air Force RSO. On October 28, 1987, I flew from Okinawa to Iran and back, an 11-hour mission into the Persian Gulf. The purpose was deadly serious. The Reagan White House wanted to know whether or not the Iranians were in possession of Chinese silkworm missiles that could be fired against shipping in the Straits of Hormuz. These missiles posed a threat against oil tankers, and the Blackbird overflights clearly showed that the Iranians indeed had silkworms in place along the coast. Knowing their exact location, we were able to forewarn the Navy and also deliver some very direct private warnings to the Iranians about what they could expect if they fired one of those silkworms at shipping. Our government was escorting tankers in and out through the narrow straits to ensure their safety. Our flight was codenamed Giant Express, and that it certainly was. We flew halfway around the world. After leaving Okinawa, we headed out toward Southeast Asia, and then south of India for our second refueling. 5 hours after taking off, we approached the Gulf region and could actually see the Navy escorting a line of tankers down below. While in acceleration after the third air refueling, I received the following radio call. "Unidentified aircraft at 40,000 feet, identify yourself or prepare to be engaged." I immediately transmitted on another UHF frequency, specifically designated for this sortie, that I was an Air Force special. I received no further response. A few months later, an Iranian civilian airliner was shot down by the U.S. Navy in the Gulf. While reading the press accounts of the incident, I recognized the identical transmission to the Airbus that I had received, probably from that very same missile frigate down below. I sometimes wonder what would have happened had I chosen not to respond to their identification demand and maintained my radio silence. Ben Rich. Some of the riskiest missions had to be personally cleared by the president and were undertaken at moments of high drama and international tensions when the chief executive's need to know what was happening inside denied or hostile territory was so explicit that issues of war and peace hung in the balance. For example, during the early hours of the 1973 Yom Kippur War, when the Arab armies caught the Israelis by surprise and scored quick victories on three separate fronts, President Nixon was informed that the Russians had repositioned their Cosmos satellite to provide their Arab clients with real-time overflight intelligence showing troop positions and deployments, a huge tactical advantage. Nixon ordered Blackbird overflights to provide these same kinds of real-time war zone overviews to the Israelis and level the battlefield. However, the British government, afraid of offending the Arabs, refused to allow the Blackbird mission to leave or land at their Mildenhall base, so we flew non-stop to the Middle East from a base in upstate New York a 12,000-mile round trip in less than half a day. By the following day, Blackbird's photo take was on the desk of the Israeli General Staff. During one of the most tense moments of his presidency, Reagan ordered the Air Force Blackbirds to mount deep penetration flights along the Polish-Soviet border in January 1982, following the Polish government's brutal crackdown against the Solidarity reformers. Poland's communist ruler, General Jaruzelski, cut communications with the West and declared martial law. The White House was deeply concerned that the Kremlin not only had ordered these drastic moves, but was about to commit troops to crush the uprising, as they had done in Czechoslovakia in 1968. Much to Reagan's relief, the overflights revealed no Soviet troop movements or any evidence of a military buildup along the border. The Blackbird flew again by direct presidential order during Operation El Dorado Canyon, the April 1986 air raid against Muammar Gaddafi of Libya, in direct retaliation for a terrorist attack against a Berlin nightclub frequented by U.S. servicemen. The Blackbirds provided post-raid reconnaissance and damage assessments. These overflights, only 6 hours following the raid, were extremely dangerous, since Libya's entire air defense system was on maximum alert and eager to bring down the prestigious Blackbird as a prized trophy. Dozens of missiles were launched, but none came close. The photo take was transmitted to the Situation Room an hour after safe landing back in Britain, completing a 6-hour, 12,000-mile round trip, and a few hours later, table-sized blow-ups of bomb damage were shown to Secretary of Defense Weinberger. One photo revealed that an errant bomb had accidentally hit an underground ammunition storage facility not far from the presidential palace. The Libyans thought that the hit was intentional and were stunned at our apparent intimate knowledge of their secret storage facilities. How did the Americans know? In my view, shared by many blue suitors, this marvelous airplane should still be operational. But alas, that was not to be. One of the most depressing moments in the history of the Skunk Works occurred on February 5, 1970, when we received a telegram from the Pentagon ordering us to destroy all the tooling for the Blackbird. All the molds, jigs, and 40,000 detailed tools were cut up for scrap and sold off at 7 cents a pound. Not only didn't the government want to pay storage costs on the tooling, but it wanted to ensure that the Blackbird never would be built again. I thought at the time that this cost-cutting decision would be deeply regretted over the years by those responsible for the national security. That decision stopped production on the whole series of Mach 3 aircraft for the remainder of this century. It was just plain dumb. But the Air Force decided that the 20 or so SR-71s remaining in service from the original procurement of 31 aircraft could suffice through the end of this century. In fact, a study by the Defense Science Board Review in 1984 concluded that the Blackbird's outer titanium skin, annealed by heat on every flight, was actually stronger than when first delivered more than a decade earlier, and would last another 30 years. The Blue Suitors decided to invest $300 million in updating the airplane's electronics, with digital flight controls and a new weather-penetrating synthetic aperture radar system, as well as refurbishing its power systems. But General Larry Welch, the Air Force Chief of Staff, staged a one-man campaign on Capitol Hill to kill the program entirely. General Welch thought sophisticated spy satellites made the SR-71 a disposable luxury. Welch had headed the Strategic Air Command and was partial to its priorities. He wanted to use SR-71 refurbishment funding for development of the B-2 bomber. He was quoted by columnist Roland Evans as saying, "The Blackbird can't fire a gun and doesn't carry a bomb, and I don't want it." Then the general went on the Hill and claimed to certain powerful committee chairmen that he could operate a wing of 15 to 20 F-15 fighter bombers with what it cost him to fly a single SR-71. That claim was bogus. So were claims by SAC generals that the SR-71 cost $400 million annually to run. The actual cost was about $260 million. SR-71 operations were not cheap, They could not fly at cruise speed longer than an hour and a half without requiring the costly and complex planning of air-to-air tanker refueling. And what really annoyed the Blue Suitors was the fact that while the Navy, the State Department, and the CIA shared in the intelligence takes acquired on SR-71 missions, none of these users helped to defray the operational expenses. In 1990, Defense Secretary Dick Cheney decided to retire the air